He's Sean Nerf Milker Watson.
And he's Phil Moof Herder DeLuca. And we are Commandarin.
Thanks for listening, everybody.
Thanks for listening.
This episode is something different, as you can probably tell by now. Sean, what are we going to be talking about?
A small independent movie called Star Wars The Force Awakens.
Ah, yes. I love indie films.
Hang on, but Phil, there's someone missing.
You are correct. Nate hasn't seen the movie yet and has opted not to have everything spoiled for himself.
It would be everything.
It will be everything, in fact. So, this special episode of Commandarin features a review of Star Wars The Force Awakens. As Sean pointed out, it's an indie film that was released recently. We will give you ample warning before we start talking about the film, and we will contain all spoilers until after that warning. However, once we're past that point, we will be spoiling the movie.
Let me pause you there, Phil. I mean, this... We're not just spoiling the movie. We are dissecting it in front of people and showing them the glistening viscera.
Absolutely.
Inside.
We're going to be talking about this film in detail. So, you've been warned. You will be warned. And after that, you have no one to blame but yourself if you hear anything you didn't want to hear. This is not that time. You can keep listening. We're going to give you 30 seconds of music before we spoil things. So, on with the show.
And those of you trying to tune in to discuss magic, we're going to discuss a little bit of Star Wars and magic-related stuff. But this is a special bonus episode of Commandarin. Don't worry, we've not gone all Siskel and Ebert on you. This is a... we might do it again in the future when other big pop culture events happen. But this is a special gift for you. Consider it a Christmas / New Year's / whatever you want gift.
Yes.
Don't worry. Yes.
So when we talk Star Wars, especially when we talk Star Wars and magic, we often think like, wow, wouldn't it be cool if somebody made... Like if Wizards made a Star Wars themed magic set. We all know there was a Star Wars collectible card game early on. And of course there's a Star Wars miniatures battle game right now. And there have been Star Wars games all throughout history itself. From even before Star Wars, people have found artifacts from previous eras. Anyway.
Frozen in carbonite.
What somebody actually did, and this is Whiny Tortoise from Imgur. Is that how you pronounce it? Imgur? We'll provide the link, but what Whiny Tortoise did was create a Star Wars set of magic, 300 or so cards, and it uses art that Whiny Tortoise has pulled from various sources, but then actually builds a magic set using all of the magic rules and the standard conventions of magic, and has created kind of a shard-based top-down design featuring the Jedi, which are Bant-colored in this set, droids, which are Esper-colored, bounty hunters, which are Jund-colored, Wookiees, beasts, and Ewoks, because all the furry things have to hang out together. That's of course, Naya. And then Sith, he portrays as Grixis, although Mark Rosewater, who is at MARO254, and others argue that they are Mardu, that there's some white in the Sith. There's a summary of this set at the Magic Show. We'll provide a link to that. And Evan Irwin, by the way, does the podcast The Magic Show. It's worth watching that. He does a very good summary of the set and how it works. It's got some really cool things, Sean. Each of those factions has a planeswalker, and the planeswalker for the Sith, of course, is Darth Sidious.
I presume the planeswalker for the Wookiees, Beasts, and Ewoks is Salacious Crumb, that little laughing thing.
You would think so. He's actually in the Bounty Hunter faction.
Of course he is.
Yeah. And the planeswalker for the Wookiees, Beasts, and Ewoks is none other...
Chewie?
Nope. Ranger Wicket, the Ewok.
Ah, there you go. Yeah. Yeah. Can I just, for the record, just say, yub yub.
Please don't say that.
I've looked at this set, and Whiny Tortoise, I don't know if you're a man or a lady, but Whiny Tortoise has put a lot of work into
this. Oh my goodness.
This isn't just a fly-by, hey, I've got this idea, guys, I'll chuck a few cards together. This feels like it's been play-tested and stuff as well.
Yeah, the balance is a little bit off. People were pointing out, like, you know, really crazy cheap things that make all of your stormtroopers, for example, really tough, but... All in all, the...
Like a crater hoof behemoth, something like that?
Almost like a crater hoof behemoth, but like for one white mana, so...
Oh, right, okay.
Yeah, I think it's excellent. It's very well done. It's unfortunate that the Sith can't actually play Stormtroopers, because the Stormtroopers are, generally speaking, white. But and there are a couple they can play, let's be clear, but... you know, they had to do something. Stormtroopers are probably white because they all work together. Go check out the summary. Go check out the links in our show notes. Please go to our show notes and give this person, Whiny Tortoise, the props he or she deserves.
So, just as a special shout-out. So, Phil, how did you feel when you started seeing for the first time, the teaser trailers for Star Wars The Force Awakens?
I'll be honest. Ordinarily, I skip trailers, but this time around, I watched quite a few of them, and some of them were ridiculously good.
Yeah, I mean, one of them literally made me cry. A tear manfully rolled down my cheek at the line, "Chewie, we're home."
Yeah.
That was in the trailer, so that's not a spoiler. So what I didn't realize until speaking to him is that friend of the show and co-host of the Command Zone podcast, Josh Lee Kwai, edited several of those trailers. And what a fantastic, breathtaking job he did. He did the official Vine trailer. Excellent, excellent work, Josh. And what a privilege for him to be an editor on the trailers for what is looking likely to be the most successful movie of all time.
Yeah. Yeah, Josh, great work on the trailers you did. We were following along on Twitter kind of as you posted them. We will try to summarize what we can here, but everybody go over to Josh's Twitter feed. That's at Josh Lee Kwai, or just go to at CommandCast, because he's one of the co-hosts of the Command Zone. Ask him which trailers are his. The trailer business is tough, Sean.
I'm pretty sure it is. I mean, I'm guessing it's... Well, I mean, how many films do you see where you see the trailer and... It's either just the ones I hate the most, and the Star Wars trailers definitely didn't do this. So the ones that, like, by the end of the trailer, you basically feel like you've seen the whole film.
Oh, God, yeah. There were a couple like that ahead of Star Wars, and it's just, terrible.
Yeah, for London Has Fallen, the sequel to Olympus Has Fallen, I don't need to see that film, because I've seen the trailer for it four times.
You know, it's funny. Obviously, they do regional differences, but there was some... horrible trailer for some horrible movie, like, you know, a very preachy movie about miracles and stuff like that, that of course will come out around Easter, and
we didn't get that. We got the BFG.
The BFG?
Yeah, it's a Roald Dahl book, children's book that's been made into a film, beloved in England.
Oh, excellent.
So I guess it's what we got instead of preachy miracle movies.
Yeah. I went for the Star Trek trailer. They didn't show it, so I asked for my money back.
I could talk about that stuff. So to summarize the new Star Trek trailer quickly, because it was part of the movie-going experience for Star Wars, for me at least. So another punter in the cinema audience summarized it best. So there was this trailer, and it had the Beastie Boys Sabotage playing. Can't stand it. With Captain Kirk jumping off a cliff on a motorcycle and then sliding it over a ravine and then sort of grabbing this buxom, white and black tattooed alien lady who's spinning a bow staff around and saying, "God, we've got no ship and no crew. We're really stuck this time." And as the trailer ended, someone in the audience just went, "That's what Gene Roddenberry wanted."
Oh, that's excellent.
Just bravo, sir. He's probably not listening, but bravo.
Yeah, I saw the trailer and I'm like, all right, so Star Trek is now an action movie franchise, so I'll just have to come to accept it. But that bears almost no resemblance to the original series. And of course, Roddenberry's
vision. Or
even
Next Gen.
Yeah, even Next Gen.
Or even Next Gen.
Yeah. Anyway, so yeah, making trailers, difficult business. Josh is doing really well because he actually got three of his ideas made into trailers. And when I say he got them made, he pitched them, they were accepted, and then he freaking made them. So, way to go, Josh.
Just fantastic. Anyway.
I'm rubbing my hands together. I don't know if you can hear that.
Oh, I've got so much to say about this film.
Okay. So, after this, ladies and gentlemen, spoilers will begin in earnest. We're going to play 30 seconds of music you might recognize to give you an opportunity to reach your podcast player, rather. Fumble a little bit, sort of like I just did. Toss it, almost and catch it, and then stop it before you hear anything that spoils the movie for you.
We are going to be entering the spoiler zone in 14 parsecs.
12 parsecs.
Oh.
Okay, here we go. Music!
After the defeat of the Galactic Empire, the galaxy faces a new threat from the evil Kylo Ren and the First Order. When a defector named Finn crash lands on a desert planet, he meets Rey, a tough scavenger whose droid contains a top secret map. Together, the young duo join forces with Han Solo to make sure the Resistance receives the intelligence concerning the whereabouts of Luke Skywalker, the last of the Jedi Knights.
That was a brilliant reading.
Well, thank you. I'd like to thank my agent and my wife for sticking by me for all these years. And God. I'd like to thank none of those people. So
what are your thoughts? What do you think about the movie in general? And then we'll go into some specifics.
Okay, so this film was like a cleansing shower, washing away the putrid filth of the prequels, which had encased my passion for the Star Wars franchise for how many years now? 15, has it been? More than that, since Episode 1? I loved this film. It is not without faults, but every second of it, I had a smile from ear to ear. I fell in love with the characters. I thought it was superficial enough that people that aren't really sort of fanboys of the franchise could sit back and love it. I thought it was deep enough that fanboys of the Star Wars franchise and people who are just cinephiles, people into cinema, could take a lot from it. And I thought it was tribute enough to the original Star Wars trilogy without pandering to cliches. That's my general feelings about it.
Yeah.
I will go a lot more specific soon.
My feeling kind of echoes what one of my friends, Chad Jones, said.
Good name.
He's the husband of one of the hosts of the Pop Culture Playtime podcast. He said it's a mixtape of the original three Star Wars films.
Uh-huh.
It goes back to many of the same tropes and many of the same plot lines, including, as you mentioned, you know, a droid with a secret piece of data on it that's being hunted by the new Imperials.
Oh, yeah. Let's not kid around here. It follows the beats of particularly Episode 4, New Hope, like point for point.
Yeah. Yeah, it just mixes them up a little bit, and that's exactly what he was saying. It's a mixtape. You know, the movie opens on Tatooine. I mean, Jakku, a desert planet in the Outer Rim. Oh, I mean the Western Reaches, right? Like, okay, so we're on a desert planet again. And although we expected the ship crawl, you know, he changed the ship crawl up just a little bit so that instead of it being this big ship that comes in overhead like all of the other movies, it was this very, you know, we saw it on the shadow side and it blotted out the planet as it came in. That was kind of cool, but other than that, it felt like it was a rehash of the first movies.
If you're talking about, if we're going through the film, looking right at the very beginning, after the crawl, which is an excellent, short, punchy crawl, it puts you right into the scene of where you are. It gives you enough information that you know what's going on. It doesn't say anything like, due to a failure to return his tax returns in time, the IRS is looking out Jedi Master Luke Skywalker, who is currently in a trade dispute with his wife, who may or may not be a Gungan.
Yeah. Arguing over finances, Luke Skywalker stormed off and disappeared. Yeah.
Yeah, so it's a short punchy crawl, but the first line of the film is the wonderful Max von Sydow. And his first line is, I don't know if you picked up on this, Phil, is, this should begin to make things right. That's the opening line of the film. And that, for me, I've seen it four times, but that was the first time I saw it, I immediately thought, that is J.J. Abrams looking straight down the camera, looking at us and saying, don't worry, I've got this.
Yeah. I don't think the movie was terrible. I think the movie was actually very fun. It was enjoyable. At times, I was very emotional. But at other times, I was like, no, like, really? we had to wait 15 years for Star Wars to come back and for it to be done better than it was before. And yet at the same time, there are so many inconsistencies with how these characters are portrayed and plot loopholes and the rehashing. It just felt too much like J.J.'s Star Trek reboot. Or even worse, it actually felt too much like J.J.'s Star Trek Wrath of Khan.
Star Trek Into Darkness.
Yeah, Into Darkness, right. But it was Wrath of Khan, right? And it felt too much like that, where a lot of the lines were just sort of switched around. The foreshadowing was blatant. The way the characters were treated, it was sort of like it was almost an inside joke at times. And I really liked it. I liked it better than Episode 1, certainly. I liked it better than Episode 2. The starship fighting in Episode 3 was really good, but otherwise it was a terrible movie. And so, you know, we're comparing it against, really, Empire Strikes Back and Star Wars and Return of the Jedi.
I genuinely think this is the second best Star Wars film.
Yeah.
Behind Empire, obviously.
I would give a third or fourth behind Empire, Star Wars, maybe Return of the Jedi. I think in a lot of ways Return of the Jedi did more for the characters and for the story than this movie did. Of course, this is just the pilot for the new season, right? So we'll see more as it goes along.
Episode 4, if you go back and watch it...
As I have now, many times.
Yeah, me too. But so, if you go back and watch it now, at the time it was made in the 70s, which I wasn't born in 78, I was born in 81. But watching it as a young child, it has a magic to it and it's ahead of its time. And I think that if that film was made with that script now, obviously with modern effects, exactly as it is now, just with more improved visual effects, I don't think it would do anywhere near as good. I think there's a big nostalgia factor to remembering how good Episode 4 is. And I think it was an accidental classic. I don't think Lucas, he claims to have this sort of vision of what he wanted the whole time. I think he's retrofitted that into his philosophy. Irvin Kershner did an amazing job on Empire, and Return of the Jedi has excellent moments, but is ultimately let down by one or two. I think it wraps itself up too neatly. I think it needed more pathos.
It spends way too much time with Ewoks and their improbable victory over the Empire, but Lucas,
they were meant to be Wookiees, though.
Yeah, they were meant to be Wookiees.
Not they ran out of budget, but they couldn't find an affordable and practical way to have that many people in the Wookiee costumes. Because not everyone is David Prowse.
Yeah.
So. Not David Prowse. Peter
Mayhew. I was about to correct you.
Getting my Vader and my tall men in costume, all-encompassing costumes mixed up. But back onto this. So... onto Force Awakens, sorry. I find it best to talk about it. So the few people I found that have really wanted to discuss it with me, mm-hmm. because they've, really took a lot out of it, I find it's best to talk about it on a sort of character breakdown way. Because the plot is essentially a MacGuffin about passing around a droid, isn't it?
Yeah, it's...
There's not too much to say about that. It is just, as you said, an introduction to the characters for the beginning of the new series.
My main problem with the plot, before we dive into the characters, is that it's not a straightforward hero's journey kind of formula. That isn't to say that that's either good or bad, but in general, movies that follow a hero's journey plotline, a hero's journey formula, where a hero has a call to action...
Like Episode 4.
Like Episode 4... Star Wars, as we actually like to call it, right? Straightforward storyline is an excellent introduction. And it has a harmony that humans, over time, have come to appreciate and identify on an almost instinctual level. I say almost because it's culture, but every culture around the world basically has the hero's journey. We've all read Joe Campbell's, you know, Hero with a Thousand Faces. And so we've all read that, and we've all read the hero's journey, and we understand it. And this doesn't really follow that, because it isn't clear if the hero, in this case, is either Finn, and we'll get to Finn, or Rey. It looks like it's Finn, but I think Finn is in there purely as a red herring, so that we don't suspect that Rey is a Force user, and that Rey is the main character.
Rey is absolutely the main character of this. So, I mean, we're getting into character study again, which we're going to do in more detail in a second. So, I understand what you're saying. I actually think if you're looking for who is the lead character of this film, it's Han Solo.
Yeah, it could be.
Han is the lead character of this film.
In which case, it's bobbled, because he doesn't have that call to action, and we meet him already like half an hour into the film, where we've established that either or Rey is the main character, the protagonist.
But it's playing with our expectations. So we're looking, because we're looking at it as an analogue for episode 4, we're looking for who is going to be the Luke character, and we're looking for who's going to be the Han character and stuff. So for the first 30 minutes before Han turns up, we keep getting blindsided by the plot. And to me, that served as a purpose to keep you enthralled. You wanted to pay attention to these characters because you were like hooked into them. You couldn't just go, oh, you know, that character's a bit of window dressing. Yeah, the first character you meet in the film who doesn't die immediately is Poe Dameron, the Oscar Isaac character. And he's warm and he's funny and he's clearly meant to be a Han type character. But he disappears.
And then he disappears for most of the movie.
But I think he disappears because if you've got Poe in the film as a main character for a big chunk of it, there's no room for Han. And I think Poe is going to be the Han Solo analogue as we go along.
Yeah.
And one of the things I was thinking is, okay, if they're going to kind of relaunch it, they're going to have an analogue for each of the main characters from Star Wars Episode 4, in this set. And who's it going to be? And I think J.J. Abrams and Lawrence Kasdan did a very good job in actually subverting expectations about who that's going to be. I mean, as far as plot goes, it's the plot of Episode 4. It even has a Death Star.
Right.
But it has elements from the other two of the original trilogy. So it has a reveal about a character being related to another character. So, spoiler here, guys. We have already warned you about this. But Kylo Ren is Ben Solo. He is Han and Leia's son. And we have a character falling into a pit, which is all stuff from Jedi, Empire Strikes Back. And then we have stuff from Return of the Jedi.
It's a mixtape, right?
Yeah, yeah. But I think it's a mixtape with a few hints of episodes 5 and 6. It's really just... So the plot is kind of tertiary. It's a MacGuffin plot. People are chasing this droid. The droid's moving around. Do you understand what I mean by MacGuffin? I presume you do.
I do, absolutely. But you should explain it to our listeners.
So, listeners, a MacGuffin in not just cinema, but in stories, is when you have an item or an object or a character whose sole purpose is to be the driving force for other characters to pursue. So a good example would be in Pulp Fiction, the MacGuffin is the suitcase which has the mystery object in it that gets moved around. It doesn't matter what's in that suitcase. In fact, they never tell us what's in that suitcase in that film, but that's the driving force for our main characters, Vincent and...
Jules,
of course. I was going to say Marcellus. Of course it's not Marcellus. for Vincent and Jules. So that's a MacGuffin. I'm sure you're now thinking, oh yeah, look. That's weird. So we have a MacGuffin, which is BB-8, who is our R2-D2 analog. We don't need a C-3PO analog because he's in the bloody movie. Could have done without
him. And R2's in the movie, but sleeping?
Yeah, that was one of my problems. I think we should look at it in a character-by-character basis.
So let's go down the characters then. We've sort of listed them
we'll do
in
it
order.
In order of appearance.
Yeah, more or less. And we're focusing on the new characters because the old characters, all of whom make appearances in the film, are still the old characters. In fact, kind of painfully so in Han's case.
We'll touch on the old characters, I think. I think my second favourite new character is this first gentleman we're going to talk about, which is Oscar Isaac playing Poe Dameron. the best pilot in the Resistance.
Her most daring, Leia's most daring pilot, according to the Crawl. Right?
Yes.
And again, right from the Crawl, they're engaging in misdirection to keep us guessing, sure. And that would be more interesting if they had done it as some sort of a reveal. But when they say most daring pilot, everybody sort of assumes mm-hmm. it's Han Solo. And then, uh-oh, wait, here's Max von Sydow. Oh, wait. Now it's Poe Dameron, and we don't know who Poe Dameron is. And, oh, I guess we'll get to see him. Oh, wait, he goes away.
Okay, well, casting-wise...
4/5 of the movie.
Oscar Isaacs is a great casting choice. He's a good actor. He was the best thing in that terrible movie, Sucker Punch, by a long way. And everything I've seen him in, he's oozed kind of charismatic star quality. And that's what he's trying to be. He's trying to be warm and charismatic and... brave and sort of a true kind of hero character. So, but at the same time, he's a little bit kind of, what's the word I'm looking for? Snarky in a kind of hand way. And you immediately feel when he's in his scenes at the beginning, you're in kind of safe hands. He has a jibe at Kylo Ren he meets where he says, oh, you know, if I talk first, you talk first. What's the deal here? I can't really understand you with all the apparatus on.
Yeah.
You didn't like that?
No, I mean, looking back, I like it less than when I first saw it, right? When I first saw it, I was like, okay, that's kind of funny. But at the same time, it's like, oh, that really diminishes the threat of Kylo Ren, because...
Kylo Ren just punks him, just says, I don't give a rat's ass about you, take him on the ship.
Yeah, but at the same time, it completely diminishes Kylo Ren, because it shows us that Poe Dameron has no respect and no fear of Kylo Ren. You contrast that with Han Solo, right, because he's obviously the Han Solo analog. And Han at least had respect and fear for Vader. Vader was a badass that you didn't mess with, not even Han Solo messed with.
Hang on, the first time Han meets... Vader face to face, he pulls a blaster on him and starts trying to shoot him in the teeth.
Because Han is badass, but at the same time, he understands what a threat he is.
And what's the first thing Poe does to Kylo Ren when he sees him?
Well, yeah, he shoots.
Tries
to snipe him with a blaster rifle. From cover, from hiding. And he wasn't displaying any fear or intimidation of Kylo, so he didn't see Kylo as the same sort of threat as Han saw in Vader. Because his first response was to protect the people he knows and loves and shoot at Vader and then try to get out of there, but he couldn't get out because the stormtroopers came in behind him in Empire Strikes Back. Whereas Poe is being snarky and not taking it seriously. And it's like, okay, so the very first thing we do, sure, Kylo demonstrates he's badass by freezing a blaster bolt, which is something that no
that is cool.
Like no other Force user has done in any of the movies or any of the other media that I've watched and or read.
And if George Lucas was filming that scene, Kylo Ren would have deflected the blaster bolt with his lightsaber, pirouetted, and the blaster bolt would have hit a droid that had gone, Roger, Roger, as it twerked on the floor.
There's no doubt that George... Lucas might have mishandled that scene.
Or the droid would have gone, oopsie, or something like that.
But, and so altogether, what that Poe scene does is it kind of establishes that Poe is sort of a wisecracker. He's a smartass. He's, you know, he's tough, but it does it at the expense of the villain. And we didn't have that originally. And I think what that does is it then sets Kylo Ren up as something less than a badass.
Hang on. Right, I'm gonna counterpoint you here. The first time we see Vader in... and this is where I actually think Poe Dameron might end up becoming almost, not in a love interest way, but a kind of Leia analogue in a strange way. First time we see Vader, what's the first words Leia says to him? Darth Vader, I recognised your foul stench. Oh no, that's to Moff Tarkin. But she's really disrespectful. She is not fearful of Vader, the beginning of Ep 4.
Right, because we have already established that Leia is a true badass there, right?
Not the beginning of Episode 4, we haven't.
Well, she's just gotten done hiding the data and then shooting stormtroopers on her own, and she's nothing more than a diplomat.
Yeah, so Poe Dameron has just done hiding the data, shooting some stormtroopers on his own... And he's nothing but a snarky space captain.
And the first time we see Vader, he's choking someone to death.
And the first time we see Kylo Ren, he's just cut Max von Sydow's head off.
He's an old man.
He's one of the... Well, you don't know this unless you've read Aftermath, but he's the founder of the Church of the Force, which is a dumb name, by the way.
It is a very dumb name.
The Church of the Force.
That brings up the world-building aspect of this movie, right? There was no real indication of what the First Order was, that it's essentially the successor to the Empire. And who the Resistance is, and why Leia is part of the Resistance instead of the New Republic Governing Council, right? Whatever that council is.
I'll come to that scene where they destroy the Senate later. I've got individual scenes that had things that I want to talk about. Just a little right there.
All right.
Oh, we're discussing Poe Dameron way too much.
Because
as we said, he's in the film for the beginning 20 minutes. I really like his interaction with Finn, where he gives Finn his name. And in that little scene where they're in the cockpit of the TIE fighter and he's like, oh, you're Finn, or I'm going to call you Finn. Is that good? I'm Poe Dameron. And how he acted there was like how I imagine a lieutenant or someone in the military would act if they were dealing with a terrified civilian and they were trying to help them out of a situation.
Yeah, he did.
And that was really warm.
It was really well done. And that entire sequence where Finn is like, you know, where Finn says, because it's the right thing to do. And Poe Dameron is like, you need a pilot. And he's like, I need a pilot. That was clever. Pilot.
Which I think, it was great. And it should probably bring us on to Finn as a character who is a good character.
Yeah, Finn is a good character, genuinely. And Finn is played by John Boyega, who have we all seen Against the Block?
Attack the Block. Not only have I seen Attack the Block, I've walked around those South London tenements, and they are as flipping terrifying from I'm going to get mugged any second perspective that film portrays.
Yep.
If you've not seen Attack the Block, listeners, go watch it.
It's beautiful.
English sci-fi horror movie. It's great.
Yeah, it's truly beautiful. It's a lot of fun.
And John Boyega, I think, was like an absolute unknown before he did that film.
Yeah.
He was plucked from the streets, literally.
I still have friends who work at Disney, and what Disney does is they ask a bunch of the cast members if anybody wants to volunteer to help run and organize movie premieres. And so one of my friends got to be John Boyega's escort up the red carpet, but in order to do that, he had to pretend he was a bodyguard. and my friend is you know, he's also black and he's a large guy, and so he had no trouble with it. So he put on sunglasses, he was wearing a black suit with a black shirt, and he walked around and he looked all intimidating in front of John Boyega. So that was kind of fun.
Did you see what John Boyega wore to the premiere of Force Awakens?
No, I actually did not.
He was wearing what I can only describe as the most fabulous purple, deep purple with black leather trim suit, tailored perfectly with black leather gloves. Standing in front of the cameras doing all these like force poses. And it was just like, you own that moment, sir.
Yeah.
You own that moment.
Yeah, he did.
What a dude.
I'm looking at that now. But, it's excellent.
Finn, the character. So the first time we see him, he's a stormtrooper, and there's a brilliant moment, which is another JJ winking at the audience moment with Finn. So he's you don't know it's Finn at this point, but he's running through the rubble in the village on Jakku, and a stormtrooper he's with gets shot by Poe Dameron, actually. And Finn leans over to pick up his dead buddy's body, and the dead body, the guy who's just been shot, reaches his hand out, grabs Finn's face and wipes his fingers down his face and leaves three blood-stained finger marks down the stormtrooper helmet that Finn is wearing. And it was a beautiful moment, because what it says is, these are real living people. There are lives at stake. Even though it's a stormtrooper's life, these are not battle droids or clones. Well, we don't know, they're not clones. We do if you know your Star Wars universe. But these aren't battle droids. These are real people with flesh and blood. And this is all real. And Finn freaks out. He sees the blood and he freaks out. And automatically you've got a stormtrooper. You normally think of, to quote Kevin Smith, all you think of stormtrooper is killing in white uniforms. And you've got this guy who's scared on the battlefield. And you immediately go, him. I want to know his story. What's this?
Yeah.
And
He did it very well.
Yeah.
Kind of humanized him instantly. Even though he's wearing the Stormtrooper armor, at that point he became human and you could read his emotions and his movement. It was done very well.
Yeah, and then he refuses to shoot. And there's a great moment where Kylo Ren senses him, senses his pull to the light side.
Yeah.
As Kylo would put it. He walks off into the ship and it's a very interesting moment. And that begins our journey of Finn's journey to the light side. Which is a subversion of what we normally think of people's fall to the dark side, don't we?
Yeah. I find it... Now, you know, this is where I kind of have to push my glasses up on my face and sniff a little.
You?
I kind of find it difficult that FN2187, which is also another clever nod to the first movie, but FN2187, yes. Trained from birth to be a stormtrooper, right? Taken from his family, never given a name, just a number. This is his first combat, it turns out, and he doesn't fire in his first combat. And yet, how is he part of the elite troop that not only is, you know, a member of the First Order, Stormtrooper Army, but he's specifically in the division that's escorting Kylo Ren and reports directly to Captain Phasma? How did that happen?
He spent most of his life, and I think this was a direct and deliberate nod to the excellent series Space Janitors. He spent most of his life running sanitation where they built a third Death Star. I mean Starkiller Base.
And so how does that speak to becoming a stormtrooper? That just adds to the inconsistency, in my opinion. Right? How does a janitor come to become one of the elite soldiers who's escorting Kylo Ren?
Speaking as a janitor...
Yes, that's right.
I know that the professor at Tolarian Community College often asks me to fight in his elite warrior unit.
Yes, his elite wizard cadre, right?
Yeah, I'm his resident black mage.
Sure.
I mean, I'm secretly black-blue, but he likes to be blue.
Yeah, so. He hugs all the blue spells.
Yeah, he hugs the blue, so I'm his resident black mage. But, okay, yeah, I'll give you that as a consistency, that I, without stretching... too much believability, I would struggle to give you a snappy answer for.
And it just doesn't... Now, if he were a recruit who like joined the First Order because he believes that, you know, he believed all the propaganda and then saw what they were doing, sure, I can understand that. But he...
Or he's gone on combat missions before, but he's never been asked to slaughter villagers.
Right.
That would be an easier thing. It's like, what? I have to kill... They're just villagers. It would take one line of dialogue... Where he turned around to even Phasma and said, they're villagers. And she says, execute the order, FN2187. Right? And that would also give her reason that when they're back on the Star Destroyer, for her to turn up and say, FN2187, report to my... report for reconditioning.
Right.
It would have taken one line to fix that.
Maybe it ended up on the editing room floor.
But then Finn goes in this journey. I think they lead that you want him to be your Luke analog. And they want Rey, who we'll discuss next, to be your Han analog to start, because she's like a smuggler. And they've got the stuff when she's interacting with Han, and she's good with technology, and she's a pilot. And then they subvert that as the film goes on. And by the end of the film, Finn is kind of your Han analog. He's the everyman who doesn't really have anything to do with the Force and is just going along with the ride. And... Rey is your Luke character, right? By the end of it. So I think they flip it 180.
They flip it because, and again, that's part of the misdirection, right? I think John Boyega and all of the scenes that were put in the trailer, right, with him wielding a lightsaber, everybody sort of expects Finn to become that Force-sensitive and that Force-using character. And then it turns out, of course, that it's Rey, who is played by Daisy Ridley. Let's give her props here.
Bravo, Daisy Ridley.
Man. Yeah, and my only real issue with Rey is like, oh, hey, it's a Force-sensitive technological... It's a Force-sensitive technophile living on a desert planet. Wow, that's original. Where did JJ get that from? Right? And apparently all Skywalkers have to live on desert planets...
We do not know that she's a Skywalker.
Come on, she's a Skywalker. She's either a Skywalker by Leia or she's a Skywalker by Luke.
I think she's a Skywalker by Luke.
Yeah, absolutely. That's what I think.
I'll come to Mark Hamill's appearance in the film later, because for me, that was the most powerful scene in the film.
It was a great scene.
That at the end.
It was really good.
best minute of acting in the whole film,
yeah,
just from Mark Hamill. But anyway, we'll come to that in a sec. So I went with Susie the second time I saw her. Susie's my wife, listeners. And like myself, Susie is a feminist. And Susie, like myself, adored the Ray character because she's a female character. She is unequivocally the lead. As soon as she's in the film, from the minute she's in the film, she is the lead.
Yes.
You could argue it's Han's sort of denouement as a story, but from the second Han dies, Rey is absolutely... And she's, if she's not the lead character in the next two films, I don't know what's going on.
She absolutely will be. And I mean, there's no doubt about that. She's the Jedi.
I was really worried at one point. So they make a point when she first meets Finn's character on Jakku. He goes to save her because she's getting the snot being out of her two guys. By the time he's run over to her, she's disarmed and kicked the hell out of the two guys who are attacking her. And he, without a single word, Finn like gives this look of, huh.
Yeah, that was good. And he kind of looks around like, anybody else seen that?
No. Everyone all right with that? And then when the stormtroopers immediately attack or spot them, he grabs a hand. And she says a wonderful line. She says, "Why are you holding my hand? I know how to run."
Yes. Yeah.
And Susie was just like, "Yeah, she's my character."
Yeah, and that
I'm in, and I was in as well. I was like, if I had a daughter, and my son, I want them to see this character and go, "That is how a woman should be portrayed in sci-fi and fantasy fiction." Not a goddamn damsel in distress every time. Which I know Leia wasn't, but she was the only woman in the entire galaxy.
Well,
in the original Star Wars.
Yeah, film. Up until the very, very end of the movie. But
and then there was a point where she gets captured later on, Rey does, by Kylo Ren. I was like, oh my god, they're going to damsel her. They're going to damsel her after they've done so much hard work to build her up. And they don't. She subverts it. They subvert it again, and she breaks out, and when they go to rescue her a second time, Han, Chewie and Finn, she's already escaped and well on her way to getting herself out of the jam already. I just loved it.
Yeah, no, she's, I know people, she's a great character, and it seems to always occur kind of in science fiction, because we get Ridley from the Aliens movies, and
Sarah Connor
and Buffy the Vampire Slayer, right?
Buffy's a very good example.
And it has to be done somewhere. And yes, it's excellent. My daughter was in the audience with me, and it was just so nice to see that, you know, Rey wasn't being treated as an object to be rescued like Princess Leia was.
Finn makes a few allusions to trying to hit on her, but she doesn't respond to them once.
Right, not at all. Doesn't even acknowledge them.
And when she says goodbye to him at the end, she says, "I'll see you soon, my friend."
Yeah.
She's not just a prize for Finn to try and achieve.
Yeah, unlike even Star Wars, right? Where Star Wars was a hero's journey with a call to action to rescue a princess, right, from the castle and storm the castle and do all that. She handles it pretty darn well. There are a few holes in it, like, you know, she is able to use the Jedi mind trick as her first ever conscious use of the Force. And then she, without any training, she's able to pull a lightsaber from snow, which again, you know, is a nice callback to Empire Strikes Back.
Oh, but what a moment!
It was a bad moment. It was actually a good moment, but it was one of those things like, really? Like, Luke had to go through hell on a swamp planet talking to a little green...
She goes through mild discomfort on a forest planet talking to a little orange thing.
Right, and...
I'll have you know.
And so here we are, right? That's my only real quibble with the character.
Yeah. And like, taking away the feminism and the empowered woman aspect of the character, I thought she performed it really well. She has a kind of wide-eyed optimism and naivety about her, which is a perfect juxtaposition to Kylo Ren's self-assuredness and bitterness. They are a yin and a yang to each other. And I've heard a couple of people say she's just like a budget Keira Knightley. But no, Daisy Ridley acted the socks off of Keira Knightley in any kind of action. Keira Knightley's done a few good dramatic roles, but in like Pirates of the Caribbean? if you're going to do a direct comparison between female leads in action-adventure movies.
Right.
Keira Knightley isn't fit to sniff Daisy Ridley's well-placed bandaged arms.
That was not where I thought you were going. Yeah, I wouldn't compare her to Keira Knightley at all. I mean, and again, the characters are fundamentally
because she's posh in English.
Because
she's posh in English.
She's posh in what?
Posh. Posh. You know, common.
Who is posh?
And both Daisy Ridley and Keira Knightley are both posh and English.
So I wouldn't compare her to Keira Knightley's character at all, because they're fundamentally different movies and they're completely written differently, right? And they're completely different characters, because Daisy Ridley is clearly playing Rey, who is set to be, you know, the main character for this trilogy, because it's going to follow her arc. My only question is this arc actually about the redemption of Kylo Ren, which would then make it a direct parallel with Star Wars, Empire Strikes Back, and Return of the Jedi? Because that movie, that trilogy is actually the redemption of Anakin Skywalker.
Yes. Which brings us nicely onto
Kylo Ren.
Kylo Ren. Kylo, Skywalker, Solo. Combination of the name. Have you ever made your Star Wars name, Phil? Do you know how to do that?
I don't do stupid things like that.
I have. I am Wace Boothy.
Oh, sure.
But anyway, yeah.
Wace Boothy.
Wace Boothy. It's a Kylo Ren, Ben Solo.
So which of his parents does he look like?
Han. He's got Han's nose.
Oh, he does he?
Just for a start, Adam Driver is an amazing actor and is brilliant in the series Girls. He is a weird-looking man.
He is a weird-looking man. In the interview I read, I just, kind of preparing for this show, I read an interview with him from last year. And they say he has striking but unconventional looks. and it's true, right? And I'm not saying...
Equine. He's very equine.
Or, what is it? Aquilinian, right? It's a Roman sort of look. But... really, all that aside, he doesn't look anything like either of his parents. He does not look like Han Solo.
I could see a bit of Han. Although I thought he looked mostly like evil Anakin at the end of Revenge of the Sith. Mm-hmm. Do you know who he looks like? This isn't Star Wars related. He looks like Alan Rickman playing Severus Snape.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. So if Han Solo had
been
played by
both costume, hair, and face.
So if he had been, if Han Solo had been played by Alan Rickman, this would have been the perfect casting for it. As it is, in terms of looks, Kylo Ren isn't anything like his parents. Except he's male and human.
I think a young Harrison Ford, if you go back to episode 4, there is a resemblance. They've both got quite defined jawlines. They do have a strong bridged nose. The ears are a bit strange.
Well, tell you what, we'll put...
Adam Driver, if you're listening to this... I think you were possibly my second favorite thing in the whole film. So please don't be upset.
Yeah, don't be upset. It was a very well-played role. I have no idea why we can even make the judgment right now about whose looks he inherited from his parents, because why did J.J. Abrams take the helmet off of the villain?
He was subverting the expectation on purpose.
Why did he do it twice?
So he doesn't take it off until the end of the second act.
Yeah.
And they don't take Vader's helmet off. I forget the prequels. But they don't take Vader's helmet off until the end of the third film.
Well, no. So in Empire Strikes Back, he's in the chamber.
You see the back of his skull. That's right. That doesn't count. That's like a little tease. Yeah. That's like a little... Ooh, flashed a little bit of nip there at the beginning of a James Bond title sequence. You know, that doesn't count. And I think they were on purposely subverting that. And they were showing that Han says the perfect line when he walks up to speak to him. He says, take that mask off. You don't need it. And that was a parent telling off their child who's just had 2 lip piercings and saying, take them out. You don't need them. You're ruining yourself. And
no, it was more about face me. Don't hide behind the mask.
And also, if he had the mask on, the scene where they do it, I don't think it was a very good scene in the film anyway, or a very well executed scene.
No, it wasn't.
The scene where Rey has a force battle with Kylo while she's strapped in the torture chair. And she forces him back and says, I've read your mind. The truth is, you're scared. You're scared you'll never be as powerful as Darth Vader.
Yeah.
And he says, enough of this shit. I'm getting out of here, and goes and cries to Snoke. That scene wouldn't have worked without... I mean, it barely worked without the mask. It wouldn't have worked with a mask.
Yeah, the best part of that scene is Rey realizing, and you could see it on her face, that she could resist him. And she could resist him more than just thinking about oranges or puppies, right? She could...
or islands. She thinks about an island when she first thinks about tries, doesn't she?
But...
And he says, I can see that island, you know.
Which maybe...
That was cool.
...was from her future. We don't know, right?
No, we can talk... Well, we should have talked about Rey's Force vision, really, before moving on to Kylo.
Well, yeah, but her Force vision is... It's kind of...
Interesting bit in the Force vision. Did you hear Yoda and Obi-Wan's voices in the Force vision?
Yes. Yes.
Yeah, particularly... I had to listen for the Yoda one on the second and third viewings, and the fourth when it was there. But the first time I saw it, I went, that was Obi-Wan saying her name.
Yep.
Anyway,
pulled
back
from
to the
word afraid. When Obi-Wan says afraid, they pulled Rey from that. Clever what you
Very
can
clever.
Do with audio.
They didn't just get Ewan McGregor to come in and go, Rey.
Well,
he'll do his really terrible Alec Guinness impression.
They had Ewan McGregor read that part.
Oh, did they?
I mean, not that there's much to read there, but they had him read it. They also pulled it from the original Obi-Wan. They pulled Yoda. And then, of course, they did the final mix there. So...
They didn't bother to get Frank Oz in, no?
No, Frank Oz with Yoda from his original.
Yeah, movie. I'm saying they didn't bother to get Frank Oz in, did they? So Kylo Ren.
But that evolution of that scene was actually good because it showed Rey really kind of discovering her powers, right? That she has these abilities and she can do it. And that's what made her realize that she had the Force, right? It reinforced the lesson from that golden puppet in the forest on the Naboo analog. And yeah, so Kylo Ren...
Kylo Ren is how they should have done Anakin. A petulant, angry, bitter teenager, or sort of, you know, childish adult, or immature adult rather than childish, who is prone to anger outbursts and believes his own hype, but at the same time is incredibly insecure. Not, I hate sand! You love me so much, and when I look at you, you fill me with loving love. I killed them, all of them. Thanks, Hayden. Thanks. Ugh.
Nobody thinks I'm great except the Chancellor. He should be my daddy. I hate you. I just want to point out that we once again have a Skywalker villain with daddy issues.
He's a solo villain.
This is a Skywalker.
And... unlike all the other Skywalkers, right? And I include Luke in that. Kylo Ren, definitely, without any room for ambiguity, resolves his daddy issues.
Yeah, and I hated... I actually hated the way that was set up. And listeners, we're specifically talking about when Kylo ignites his lightsaber right through Han Solo. So...
Oh, you could see it coming, where it goes red and the sun dips from because it's being drained.
Yeah, you could see it when he hugged Leia
and
goodbye.
And he says, oh, well, we knew Harrison Ford wasn't going to do more than one. He wanted Han to die in Jabba's palace at the beginning of Return of the Jedi.
Yeah.
So the School of Movies podcast, which I'll talk about at the end a bit more, did an alternative ending for Han Solo at the end of Return of the Jedi that would have been a beautiful, beautiful thing if it had happened, which Alex Shaw, who's the host of that show, said that he envisaged the perfect ending for Han would have been Han, instead of Lando, is flying the Millennium Falcon to destroy the second Death Star. And he's ignited the thermo detonator inside it, you know, the core of the Death Star, and exploding. The Falcon is flying out, but the flames are too fast and are going to catch the Falcon and destroy it. And as he's going, he manages to radio Leia down on the planet's surface. And at that point, they echo the I love you, I know moment, where he says to her, I love you. And she resigns herself and says, I know.
Yeah.
And then the Falcon dies and Han dies in the explosion. And Leia is torn between triumph of defeating the Empire and despair at losing the only man she ever needed and loved. And that would have been an ending.
Sean, you made me cry.
Yeah. Alex Shaw of School of Movies podcast made you cry.
Yeah, as with many things, somebody else writing that would have done a better job than Lucas.
Okay, so Kylo Ren, the him killing Han, it was a necessity. They set it up. Well, I liked the lines where he said, "I can feel the seduction of the light side." And it was a nice, once again, a subversion of our understanding. The language in Star Wars is you fall to the dark side, you feel the pull of the dark side seduces you. And his subversion of that, and he can feel the light side pulling him, and he's seduced by it, was really nice. It's such a simple thing, but it invoked, oh, this is a bad guy. He can feel the light, and he's purposely oppressing it.
No, it's not that he's a bad guy. It's that he's just fighting it, right? I mean, he's a spoiled kid.
He's entitled.
Is what it comes down to it.
Yeah,
he's entitled. He's a cisgendered white male.
He was born on third, but thinks he hit a triple, to use a sports analogy.
Yeah, that's good. That conflict, right? That call to the light side. I get that. That's really cool. And that was even before it was revealed officially that he was Ben Solo, right? Or any of the Skywalker brood. And that was nice. That was a powerful moment. Killing Han, another powerful moment. I have a standard, and only true Star Trek geeks are going to get this one. But my wife and I say, you know, was a death more or less powerful than Jadzia Dax's death on Star Trek?
Ooh, DS9,
right? Because that death was so meaningless. It so clearly showed that the writers and the directors, like the showrunners, were angry at her because she had basically accepted another job and was bailing on them. So they gave her this meaningless death, this character that we had known for how long? They gave her this meaningless death, right? And so Han, we all know he's going to die.
It's the Joey from Friends character in the soap opera where he's going to step into the lift.
Right.
He's like, okay, I'm going to get in the lift now. That moment. The writer's just like, no, get off my show.
Yeah, it was...
But Han's death moment, right, it had to come. And it gives... So how is there any coming back for Kylo? So you're worried that it's going to become a redemption story for Kylo. I think he's unredeemable at this point. I think he's gone too far. And I think Rey is going to have to take him out. Or is that just going to be Snoke?
I don't know.
Or is it going to Luke's going to have to take out Snoke? We'll come to Snoke in a sec. I just wanted to discuss, before we move on to another character, that lightsaber fight between Rey and Kylo at the end.
That was good.
So, unlike a lot of people, I hated the lightsaber fights in the prequels. They don't look like fights. They look like stupid ballets.
Mm-hmm.
Choreographed nonsense. And you can say, oh, well, you know, they're Jedi Masters. They will never strike a blow on each other because they're all so good at their art and yada, 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 yada.
They never get tired.
No. Right? And then for a long time, I thought the best fight in all of Star Wars was Luke versus Vader at the end of Return of the Jedi, when Luke nearly falls to the dark side, loses his and just starts wailing on Vader. And it's uncoordinated, unsophisticated, and brutal.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I still think that's the best lightsaber fight in the series. This is a close second.
Yeah, they look ragged at the end of it. They've beaten each other up. And he, of course, has already been through Finn with a lightsaber. That was a lot of fun.
Finn with a lightsaber strike up the spine. Ow!
Yeah,
I winced when he took that hit.
Yeah, me too.
Oh, Jesus Christ! And they're not just like lopping off limbs and stuff. They're all stabbing each other, and it looks painful. The fighting.
Yeah, it was what characterized this lightsaber battle. It was pain, right? You're using blades made of laser beams.
Yeah. Speaking of pain, Kylo Ren, so a couple of people I've watched this with didn't know why Kylo Ren was punching that blaster wound he has on his side. He does it twice during that fight. I'm like, he's drawing energy from the pain. He's psyching himself up.
Yep.
If he's using Sith philosophy, and I know he's not a Sith technically, although he clearly is, they draw power from pain. So he's punching his wound to... so he can focus his dark side energy.
Well, I've seen that in other movies as well, right? Where a warrior takes a hit and actually punches the wound in order to...
yes.
Yeah. Build up that same energy.
Yeah, and and listener Pete, to Commander Inn, and my friend Ian, who's also a Commander player with us, they both were just like, oh no, it was stupid. I was like, no, it's not stupid, it's brilliant. What did you want? Did you want him to pirouette around? And he's like, until she has her force moment where she clears her mind using the light side and then fights him back, he's just anger and bitterness and pain personified, and he's stalking her like a horror movie
view. Yeah.
And through that little snowy canyon, he's spinning that cool looking lightsaber with the crossguard, and it's a sort of amateurly made, so the energy in the lightsabers are crackling and fizzling in the snow, and you just feel, and even though you know that they're not going to kill her, you feel worried for her. It was such a beautiful fight, and by beautiful I don't mean choreographed, I mean emotional, and that's what Star Wars should be. Its heart should be an emotional experience.
Yeah, there's absolutely no argument. I mean, I agree. I enjoyed this film, and that fight was a beautiful fight. The same way, I was like, wow, this is raw. You know, this is two people with swords fighting for their lives.
And there was weight, and they felt like swords as well. They didn't feel like light sticks. They were swinging them with power and punch in the swords.
Yeah.
Oh. And then he's got her on the edge of the cliff, and she closes her mind, and she says the Force. She remembers what Maz Kanata, who was a great character as well. She remembers what Maz said to her, and she clears her mind and focuses. And then you've got the anger and pain of the dark side versus the clarity of thought of the light side. And you see these great powers clash in these two characters who we only met an hour and 50 minutes beforehand. And for all of that is why I can forgive some of the misgivings in the plot.
Yeah.
And I'm quite passionate about this, if you noticed.
What I really enjoyed about this, overall, the film, and we're still not even done with the characters, but what I really enjoyed about this film was it was dirty, and it was gritty, and it was human. And I don't mean gritty in the same way that people are like, wow, Wolverine is so gritty, right? I mean like gritty, like you just look around and everything is scuffed again. It's not the bright and shiny episode 1, 2, and 3. And we know why, because they're basically in this collapse of the government and their civilization is in the process of collapsing. And so they have to reuse stuff. And it drives it home with her technophile aspect, right? Where she's, when we first meet her, she's scavenging things from a destroyed Star Destroyer.
Yeah. That's a good costume. The costume in this were brilliant as well.
And that lightsaber battle is everything. It encapsulates this era of Star Wars, right? It's brutal. It's gritty. It's not pretty. Anyway,
in the snow, it was a bit. If I had to make one, and it is a tiny criticism of it, is it reminded me a little bit of some of the parts of the latter two Harry Potter films in a purely visual sense, because they're in the snow, and like the Battle of Hogwarts where Voldemort and Harry face off, there's the ashes falling down around them, and you've got these two people in this emotional battle knocking seven shades of shite out of each other.
Yeah.
But, I mean, it was a small evocation of visuals, because it was in, you know, and then ultimately you could argue that Harry Potter, that scene was borrowing from the throne room scene at the end of Jedi, in a lot of ways, with the lighting of it and the sort of viscera of it going on. So, but it was just, it was so, that there was only one scene I preferred more, and it was the very final scene of the film. Should we move on to another character?
Yeah, and we don't have to go to BB-8.
BB-8 was cool. He wasn't, I was worried he was going to be annoying as hell, and he was actually sweet and actually funny at more than one point.
So a lot of people are not going to realize this either. I mean, they look at that BB-8 droid. It was actually made at that size for the movie as a prop, and it wasn't a prop that was puppeted, except that it was radio-controlled. It actually rolled. It actually had a head on top. It's made by the same company that makes the Sphero remote-control ball thing, right? The Bluetooth-controlled ball. If you roll that around, it has a little apparatus inside that just kind of rolls it around like a hamster in a cage.
And they've got like an electromagnet on top that they can
and they
hover that head around.
And they wirelessly control it through essentially a router embedded in the center of the robot.
It was so cool.
Yeah, it really was cool. There's a toy on the market now, $160 or something. The one that actually works like he does is made by Sphero. And it's pretty good. It rolls around nice. The head kind of comes off a lot, so that's unfortunate. But it works essentially identically to the way BB-8 in the movie did. And that, by the way, the effects on BB-8, I thought, were wonderful. When BB-8 rolls up to Finn and is zapping him with the electro probe or whatever it is. Very funny.
Stop it!
Right? Yeah, very funny. And then he tells him he's dead and Poe didn't make it and yada yada. And then he gets sad. Ooh. And as he turns, the ball rolls and they flip the control in just as the head kind of passes over that section. Very well done. Very well done. So yeah, kudos to
I liked people. His sound design was very good as well. Like there are points where he sounded a bit like a purring cat.
Yeah.
Where he was happy. When she says, come on then.
Yeah.
I was like, oh, it's wonderful. Yep. Like Susie liked BB-8. And I was like, yeah, it's worked well. He's got that kind of quiet cuteness to him without being intensely annoying.
Yeah, it's nice. And when he meets R2 and R2 wakes up from his stupid sleep. Which, you know, I asked my wife, I was like, what was he doing? And she was looking
through his data banks for the map.
Reconstructing this. And I'm like, wow.
And he very luckily found it at just the right dramatic moment.
Which some people think was Luke reaching out with the Force to turn R2 on, but whatever.
Bold.
Yeah, I know. I was like, wait a second. So
it's plot convenience.
So it takes him 23 years to look through his database. Like, how much memory does R2 actually have? This is insane.
Well, I mean, Kylo Ren's got a copy of the map in the Imperial Archives. So presumably R2 has the entirety of the Imperial Archives inside it.
First of all, I have to ask, what is with this map? I mean, I know it's to the buried treasure, right? And I get that. But why is there a map at all? And why is there a map in the Imperial Archives that has a convenient orange line going through it, leading to a gap in the map?
At first I thought, well, Max von Sydow must have made the map as like a safety net to make sure that if they ever needed Luke, they could find him. Because in the background, in the Aftermath book, he's like a holy worshipper of the light side. But then I thought, why would he have a map that was incomplete? Why wouldn't you just say to Poe Dameron, it is time. He's on planet Lucius. You know, was he just being a cryptic old bastard on purpose? Like, yeah, it was. They could have simply tweaked it to make it better. It could have been encrypted or something, and they had to put the encryption into R2, so R2 had to decode it.
Whatever.
It sounds, fine. Anyway, Supreme Leader Snoke.
You know what I mean? It's character. Like the map. Who cares at this point? It's like, okay.
It's a MacGuffin.
The other thing is, it's the MacGuffin, and I get it. But then it begs the question, like, why are they looking for Luke?
They say that. The Snoke. I could tell you why the First Order are looking for Luke.
Well, I don't care about the First Order just wants to exterminate him. Sure, whatever. Why is the Rebellion, I mean the Resistance, looking for Luke?
It says in the opening crawl, Leia is the one looking for Luke.
So what?
It's not the whole Resistance. It's like, because she believes that he is the only one who can. Like, she is screwed. They don't know what to do, the Resistance. They are burnt out. They have no plan. And she is clutching at straws and says, "Well, the only person I know that can help us here is my brother."
This is what they do. If they're tired and burnt out, what they do is they get a good night's sleep. They order
They get a good Jedi night's sleep.
Then they get a Jedi pizza, and they get some Jedi beer, and they drink they each have like one or two beers, and then they have a brainstorming session. What are we gonna do? They don't spend 23 years looking for one person. Even a single person as powerful as Luke. No.
So I think this is conjecture, right? So I reckon when Luke has set up the new Jedi temple, he's training a new group of Jedi.
Oh, so you're saying we're going to see the new Jedi Order?
No, I think the Knights of Ren, which Kylo is the head of, are the remainder of the new Jedi Order that fell to the dark side. And Luke lost all his apprentices, Padawans. They were either killed or fell to the dark side. And it's like a crushing failure. And that's why Luke's gone into hiding. He's let down his sister, his friends. And Leia's character arc in this is essentially, outside of being a general, is essentially a bridge builder. She's trying to build bridges to her son, to her estranged, we don't know if they were married, her estranged lover and her brother. She's looking for unity in the Force. Because she's a Force user, don't really think.
Yeah,
she's
absolutely.
Not a Jedi.
No, she feels it when Han dies.
She senses it when Han dies, yeah. So she is looking to unify. She's recognized that unifying the Skywalker clan will unify the Force.
And so you think that's what it is, that she is unifying the Force.
I think she is trying to unify the Skywalkers to unify the Force. She's the one that can see the actual big picture, which is, it's not really about light side and dark side. It's what Qui-Gon wanted, a balance in the Force. So maybe Leia turns out to be the true balancer of the Force. I doubt it, because Carrie Fisher can hardly speak, but...
I don't know what you're talking about there, Sean.
My jaw is wired shut with Botox.
Hey,
and I smoke.
Yeah, hey, hey, would you light this cigarette for me? I can't flick my thumb like I used to be able to.
Could you just shove it between my lips, because my jaw won't open far enough?
You know, I just wish I didn't have such bad coke in the 80s.
Oh my god, my septum is falling out. Chewie, honey, will you pick it up for me?
Oh, Chewie. Hey, Chewie, do me a favor. Just pour me another drink, will ya? All right,
I'm so happy this film came along. I was stuck doing Kevin Smith cameo roles. But...
Oh, come on. I mean, okay, if we're going to make fun of them for their age, Han, look at Harrison Ford. Poor Harrison.
Oh, yeah.
He's stooped. You know, his head is, he's got that perpetual...
He's got the old man walk, so yeah. He walks with his knees, like, wobbles apart. But they did make a point of making him look badass. I really hated the way that he used Chewie's bowcaster.
Oh,
I went,
so
oh, nice. Hey, that's really good. I'm like, you've known each other for a multitude of decades. You're telling me you've never once had the need to pick that bloody gun up and fire it?
It was so lame.
That was them using arguably the most popular character in the entire series to say, hey guys, Chewie's gun's really cool, isn't it? Like, why? Why, JJ?
Hey, Chewie.
Chewie, that thing that looks like a blaster, why is it also a crossbow?
Yeah.
Oh, even though you never loaded like a crossbow.
All I kept expecting Han to go, kids these days. like to see some high-tech marvel and be like startled, like, whoa, I didn't know they could do that.
I didn't hate Han Solo in this film.
No.
I do think it's a shame there wasn't a single shot or opportunity to have all of, you know, Han, Leia, Luke and Chewie in the same room together. But, you know, I also agree that it may have been pandering too much.
Oh, absolutely. I think that Han and Chewie and Leia were there basically to introduce the next generation. And Han
doesn't like Luke anymore. When they say, you knew Luke Skywalker, he says, yeah, I knew Luke.
Yeah.
Like, his reaction when they bring up Luke isn't, oh, he was my best buddy or anything like that.
Well, he probably holds him responsible.
Yeah, there's a resentment there. A real resentment.
Clearly, there's been some world building, right? But it hasn't been shown to us. Not all of it.
It will come in. Yeah, it will come in.
Maybe it will. So, speaking of Supreme Leader Snoke...
So, Supreme Leader Snoke was my one disappointment in this. And let me tell you why. It wasn't my one disappointment. It was my biggest disappointment.
It was my biggest disappointment, too.
Even, like, Maz Kanata, who is the Yoda analog, the orange lady done by Lupita Nyong'o?
Yeah.
Probably butchered the pronunciation of that. But a fine actress who I first noticed in 12 Years a Slave. She, even her, who is a primarily CGI character, didn't bother me. Snoke stuck out. It might be the way he was lit, the fact he was holographically projected to be a giant man, but he stuck out as a sore thumb, as horrendously CGI'd.
Yes.
And he was the closest thing to a prequel-type thing we saw.
Well, yeah, and when you see him, it's not apparent because there's no flickering. It's not apparent he's a
hologram.
He's a hologram, but clearly it's another callback to Empire, where you know we see the Emperor for the first time, and the Emperor is huge, and then he flickers out of existence, and it's a hologram, and that's awesome, right? That was pretty cool. But the CGI used in that, I was like, wow, I'm watching a being made of clay.
Yeah. Right. It suffered with, I'm going to coin another phrase from School of Movies podcast here, but millennial rubber, which was what early CGI heavy films, a good example is the first Spider-Man film or the first couple of Harry Potter films, where you had a character where the rest of the world is so beautifully designed it feels real, but suddenly you get one character like Spider-Man leaping around the buildings or Neville Longbottom on a broom that looks rubbery and sort of just pulls you out of the existence, the reality of the film, just for right. a second. You can forgive it and move along, but and it's weird because it's Andy Serkis. You don't expect to say that about Andy Serkis.
Well, it's Andy Serkis puppet, right? It's a digital puppet, and the problem with it, like it's all in that face, that weird facial structure that indicates some sort of scarring, which may turn out to be just
he's been swiped massively.
Yeah, like he's hurt, and you get that. There's the scars. But then the way the scars move look like they're textures on a 3D model, right?
Yes.
And that's the problem. And it's like,
And he's backlit, so he's got a glow about him, which makes him look just ethereal, which I think is what they were trying to go for, but it looked not real.
But you know what?
Which is another version of ethereal, but an essentially jarring version
of
ethereal.
It's not unreal in an ethereal sense where it looks cool and is spooky and conveys like the sense of mysticism.
Menace and mysticism.
It's unreal in the sense that, I'm watching a digital puppet.
Yeah, right? Absolutely. Okay, so but what you just said there solved a problem. Carol, go on, because you might be able to touch on the point I'm about to say.
No, I'm going to change topics.
Oh, the last thing I'll say, so I think you solved the problem, or could have solved the problem for me if you were in the effects suite. When you first see Snoke, did you find it jarring that he was a giant man?
That he was a giant who?
He's a giant guy. Did you find it jarring? Because when you first see him, there's nothing to indicate he is not just a massive giant. Huge! This like 60 foot tall.
Yeah, when you first see him, that's exactly it. It's not clear it's a hologram. But
it's not clear. So that change you suggested, which is just a little bit of holographic flicker,
yeah,
would have instantly solved that problem.
Absolutely. But I think this was all part of this misdirection, right? I think the filmmakers thought they were being clever from the very start of the movie to, you know, misdirect us and lead us. Actually, not even from the very start of the movie, from the very first time we ever see Finn wielding a lightsaber. Right.
So the second teaser trailer?
The second teaser trailer, right? From Josh. May or whenever that was. And yeah, thanks, Josh. No, I don't know.
I'm joking.
Obviously, that's funny, though. they think they're being very clever by misdirecting us. And what they're doing is actually just leaving us uncertain. And that uncertainty doesn't help us understand and appreciate the film. It detracts from it.
I think it works in some places.
Some places, sure, but it's so heavy-handed all throughout. It's like Snoke's, okay, he's a giant guy. Oh, flicker, he's gone. Oh, okay, it was a hologram, get it. Right?
I wouldn't have had Snoke in the film at all, or used him to such a small extent like they do in the original trilogy before the third film.
And I want someone to explain to me why we should take the name Snoke seriously. It's like
It is a bit of a Jar Jar name.
It's like, well, it's a Jar Jar moment. It's a Count Poo-Poo moment, right? Because, of course, Dooku is just one letter short or different from Dookie, which, as we all know, is slang for poop, right? And it's like, why are we continuing this? Snoke?
Yeah.
I guess we'll Snoke find out.
Snoke, it doesn't sound like a rude word. Like, the Dooku Dookie thing is right. Well, they should have just called him Darth Tyrannus.
right.
All the way through that.
All the way through. Yeah. And instead, they just throw that off once. Like, yeah. Oh, there was a, you know, dog. And they never ever talk about that again in the movies. But Snoke and Supreme Leader Snoke, like...
Yeah, and you've got Domhnall Gleeson, bless his ginger soul, trying to be ginger space Nazi. And you wait until Supreme Leader Snoke hears about this. And you're like, yeah, it's hard. It's already hard to take a ginger yeah. man leading an army of space Nazis seriously with that hat. But now you're saying Supreme Leader Snoke.
Snoke. I'll tell like Snoke every, on you.
I like... I did like his little, like, look at Kylo
good.
Ren when Kylo Ren gets chewed out by Snoke. And I did like the Domhnall Gleeson character. He was cool, and he was essentially the Grand Moff Tarkin we never got.
That's General Hux?
Yeah, General Hux is the character, yeah. Domhnall Gleeson's character. And I do like that he's going to be in the next one as well. But Snoke is not a good name.
No.
Is he going to turn out to be a Darth? Is he? They're going to turn out he's Darth. I mean, I've heard people suggest he's Darth Plagueis.
No, they say he's a Sith. He's not a Sith Lord, but he is a dark side Force user.
Yeah, I think the fact the line in the film made me think the Sith had gone for good is when Maz Kanata says, "I've seen evil take on many forms: the Sith, the Empire, and now it's the First Order," which would imply the Sith is something that is done. And the dark side, it's still just a continuation of the dark side. The Sith was just a name.
Yeah.
Which I kind of like. Like, the Sith were as a... Forgive me, listeners, if I refer to...
You are about to be burned at the stake if you say what I think you're going to say.
No, I don't think I'm going to. I was going to say, forgive me, listeners, if I refer to the Knights of Ren as the Sith. Because I know they're not.
I thought you were going somewhere else. Like, the Sith are kind of weak, and I know that there are, you know, fans that will find you and kill you if you said that.
I like the Sith philosophy in real life. So the dark side, light side was explained to me by my boss, Paul Evans at Games Workshop, who was a Star Wars fanboy. He said, right, so let's imagine you're an arachnophobe, yeah, a severe arachnophobe, and you need to take a wicked dump. And you go to your toilet and there's a big old mean spider on the lip of your toilet seat. The light side user will go away, gather his thoughts, calm down, tell himself it's just a spider, go pick up the spider, put it somewhere else, sit down and take a dump. Whereas the dark side user will go, oh my god, it's a spider, I've just got a spider! Squash the spider. And that's the difference between the two approaches.
Yes.
And... what appeals to you more? Go for it.
And I regularly am picking up spiders on a piece of paper and bringing them outside.
What I do if there's a spider in my house is I go get my cat, who is a frequent eater of spiders, go and put him near the spider.
Yeah, I had a cat that did that. My current cat kind of looks at it and he runs away, assuming he even lets me touch him.
Oh, right, he's one of those cats, right. Now, right. If cats like the taste of spiders so much, why is there not spider-flavored cat food? Is a question.
There's a market.
Yeah. But we could talk endlessly about other characters in this. Maz Kanata's a great character. General Hux is a great character. Admiral Akbar appears to have his original rubber face is in this film. He
was that Admiral Akbar or was that somebody else?
It's certainly got Akbar's voice.
Another Mon Calamari. I mean, how different do Squid
Yeah, but
sound?
He's definitely got Akbar's voice. I think it might even be the same voice actor. I liked the guy from Heroes playing the new Porkins.
Yeah, but at the same time...
It's not a Resistance X-Wing fight if there's not a fat pilot.
A fat bearded pilot.
Yeah, and I'm a fat non-bearded man. Not as fat as I was, bear in mind, but I'm still a fat non-bearded man. And I've now got a cosplay to do at... Star Wars conventions. Thanks, guys.
That's funny.
And part of me thinks that's why it's there, and that's not a joke.
That's true. We fat guys got to have something to play.
Yeah.
Besides,
if I see
Boba
the
Fett's.
First time I see a fat male Rey, I might gouge my own eyes out with a lightsaber.
Oh, you'll see it.
Oh God.
So Pirate Yoda. Pirate Yoda was good. Porkins 2 or Porkins Boogaloo or whatever his name is. That was okay. Yeah. My least
Grand Moff Ginger was pretty good.
Grand Moff Ginger. Yeah. My least favorite part of the movie, my least favorite scene of the movie was that ridiculously dumb brainstorming session they were having around the hologram of this giant Death Star.
Right? Oh, yeah. That's not the Death Star. This is the Death Star. Well, call that a knife? This is a knife.
Yeah, exactly. It's a Ringworld moment. Oh, you thought that was big.
I didn't like the scene with the Rathtars, the giant squid aliens.
Yeah.
I thought that was a bit dumb and unnecessary.
Well, yeah. I mean, they had to get old Han away from those space pirate clans he had double-crossed.
The Scottish space pirate. And did you think it was a wee bit kind of unnecessarily racist to have one of the space clans to be all played by Asian guys?
They were actually both led by choreographers from Southeast Asian or Thai, actually, action movies. And they both worked on The Raid and The Raid 2.
The Scottish guy? Oh, yeah, actually, this The Raid was directed by a man from Wales. But I don't know who the Scottish guy was. Like, from Guavian Death Dealers or whatever they were.
They were both fight choreographers.
Okay, but did they need to make the rest of... Were they all fight choreographers? Were they all stuntmen?
I don't know who the rest of them were. I know the leaders were the fight choreographers. And let's face it, like maybe that was the case. There were no Nemoidians. There were no, you know, Gungans. Right?
Would you like wonton soup? Oh my God, George, really?
Yeah.
So... Don't get me started on Watto.
But my least... My least favorite scene is brainstorming scene where they're like, oh, how does it recharge? It eats suns. Well, then it must have a thermal oscillator. What if we blow the thermal oscillator up, right? And it's this approach to like was any kind of planner consulted in the making of that scene? Because this isn't the way it's done.
I was half expecting there to be a line in that scene because the tone of the scene was put across by us. I was expecting someone to say, well, surely there's a tiny porthole we can exploit, or something like that, or, you know, or some Admiral Akbar to say, well, unfortunately, they've blocked up all exhaust ports, or, you know, some dumb ass comment, but they avoided that at least.
Oh, this is interesting. In looking up Admiral Akbar, I've discovered that Daniel Craig of James Bond...
You know who he is?
He played a stormtrooper. Let's see.
He plays the stormtrooper who she mind tricks.
Oh, that's great.
And if you watch him walk out of the room when he drops the gun, you can see his body shape. That Bond triangular solid shoulders down to like a really small hips.
It's funny.
I can see it's Daniel Craig.
I noticed it was totally like, I noticed the trooper was shaped buff like that. And I was like, I know that troopers walk, but I just thought it was like a nice casual kind of throwaway that they really directed the hell out of. But to have Daniel Craig in there, that's good.
It's Daniel Craig. Did you see Simon Pegg?
No, I didn't see Simon Pegg.
Simon Pegg is the guy who says 1/4 portion.
Is that him?
Heavily made up.
That's great. And he's the one who's holding her hand in that little
flashback. And her hand in that force flashback, Yeah, that's Simon Pegg.
That's great. Way to go. That's fun. All right, so...
Although I really hope he's not a lead character in the next film.
He can't be. I mean, unless he's made up totally differently, so...
Yeah.
All right, so any other characters we want to call out? Han's reversion to smuggling, that was just dumb.
Yeah, he's gone back to what he knows after his son.
But the way they executed that was dumb. You know, double-crossing two clans, and then they both find his super space freighter or whatever it is.
At the same time.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was a bit silly. I thought that the sort of comedy, the gimlying of Chewie was a bit annoying with the, oh, you must be really brave. And why it made me laugh the first time I saw it, the second, third time it annoyed me a little bit.
Like, yeah.
Chewie's a badass normally. He takes no crap. And then you've got this very nice rebel doctor. You know, he nearly kills Finn when Finn's trying to help him. And then he's going, oh, I'm sure it really hurts. You must be a big, brave boy. You know, what? Any other nice moments you noticed that were quite subtle There was a subtle costume change in one of the characters I thought was nice.
What, when they clean Finn's jacket?
Finn starts wearing a full black bodysuit when he drops his Stormtrooper armor, and at the end of the film, if you look, where he's laying in the medbay and Rey kissing goodbye, he's wearing like the white light side Jedi robes.
Yeah, like. I just attributed that to the medical outfit.
Yeah, but I thought it was just a subtle visual tick. I like the bit where Finn picks up the where he's desperately rummaging through stuff on the Falcon. He picks up the training probe and chucks it to one side.
Yeah, that was cute. Quite nice. That was cute.
I liked the moment with Rey bollocking Finn because he's trying, not picking up the wrench. That one. Yes. That one. No, there.
With BB-8.
No, there.
No. BB-8 looks at it.
Susie looks up at me as if to say, "Are you watching, Sean?" Yes, you know this moment, don't you? We've done this before, haven't we? I feel like that about you.
So we have pretty much talked the hell out of this show.
Apart from one final scene we've not discussed. And it's the final scene of the movie.
That's right, the final scene. It's brilliantly shot.
Saving the best till last.
I kind of expected him to turn around and say, "I have climbed Irish mountains."
The west of Scotland is. The Highlands of Scotland. If
oh, is it?
Yeah. So, what's the final line, spoken line of the film?
I have no idea.
Carrie Fisher turns to Rey and says, "Rey, may the Force be with you." It's a beautiful bookend to "Let's begin to make things right."
Mm-hmm.
And I loved that. And then Rey goes to the beautiful mountains with the ancient Celtic stairway carved into the rock. And she sees, you see briefly, she looks at some monks, looks like sort of very rustic, almost like Kung Fu Master Kill Bill, when the bride goes to see Master Paime, that kind of like out living hermity kind of rice cooker type stuff. Then she carries on working up and she sees this shrouded figure in a sort of dirty grey green brown off colour cloak. And the music, kudos to the editing and John Williams on the score on this scene.
Yeah.
Made me cry like a little boy. So the music swells up and it's almost ominous at first. And she stands there and he turns and you see this sort of, old man. You see how old he's become. He's become like Obi-Wan was.
Yeah.
Out in the Dune Sea. And he looks, he's got the hood and she slings her staff and just looks at him optimistically. And she remembers the saber. She gets it out and offers him it. As he pulls his hood down, it closes on him, a shot of him, and he looks at first confused, and then his eyes very subtly focus on the saber, and it cuts back to her face, and she's looking. She's got this look of optimism and hope, and just that's it, pure yeah. optimism and hope in her eyes, and it cuts back to Howell, and it's the greatest moment of acting in the whole film. It lingers on his face for maybe 3 seconds, and you can see a tear welling in his eye, yeah. And he has this expression that has both hope and optimism, but fear and pain all at once in his face, and just like, oh my God, Mark Hamill, in a few seconds you have out-acted everyone in this film. And then there's an amazing pan shot, sweeping shot in a helicopter around them both of a perspective, and it lingers on it for ages, and you know that is about to hit, and you just, and then it comes and you're just like, why is it not episode 8 already? It's beautiful.
It's a brilliantly shot scene. I think we know where most of the directorial and acting efforts went. Right into that scene. It absolutely does wonders for the film. It's a great way to end it. And it leaves it on a better cliffhanger than any action scene could have, or any scene of peril. Right.
Well, at first I thought they were going to end it when they're all celebrating back at the Resistance base. And Leia meets Rey and hugs her. And I thought, are they going to imply by that it's a mother-daughter moment? An unknown mother-daughter moment, but they can feel a connection.
It's the misdirection again at play.
Yeah, and I thought that's where they're going to end it. But then you get the little brief scene with them completing the map, which is a bit dumb. And then her saying to Finn, "We will meet again. I truly believe that. Thank you, my friend." She kisses him on the forehead. And you know that that's not going to be the romance arc of the story. Or at least that's not how they're playing it now, which was nice for me.
I don't think we're going to see a romantic arc to this story.
Well, I mean, you could argue there wasn't a lot of romance in the other ones, but I mean, a love interest. They're not just going to play Rey as the love interest of Finn, or vice versa, I don't think. And I only say Rey is the love interest of Finn because that, in a traditional movie paradigm, is the woman is the love interest of the male lead. But they've already subverted that. I don't think we're going to see it. But then you see her. She's complete at that moment. She's taken her first step. That's the only point in the whole film she changes her costume as well. Did you notice that?
Yeah.
Yeah, she's wearing that weird little waistcoat thing. And is Chewie going to be her new best bud?
Well, it looks like she's the co-pilot, or he's the co-pilot to her pilot.
Yeah, yeah.
So maybe. I think it set us up for the next film very well. I was very worried when they completed the map and it was clear they were going to go somewhere. I was like, no, just end the movie there. It was a good ending. And then they actually surpass that, right, with that particular ending, because it leaves us wanting so much more. So I guess the question we have now is, and, you know, it's a little late because our listeners have all been spoiled at this point. We've spoiled it for the listeners, but do they go see it?
Oh, yes. more than once.
Yeah, I say yes as well. And I'm going for my second time tomorrow, I think. So,
Can I ask a more pertinent question? If you were or had a friend who had never seen a Star Wars film in their entire life, would you take them to see it?
I don't know. I don't know. Because I think the grounding in the characters is... I think there's a lot of assumption about knowing who these characters are. When Han and Chewie show up and say, we're home, we're not introduced to these characters except in the fact, like, you know, if you didn't know the previous movies, you'd be like, well, what do you mean we're home? This makes no sense. Because they never explain it. He only goes on to say that he lost the Millennium Falcon. Somebody stole it from him, which I find preposterous, right?
Oh, he's lost it before.
Well,
he loses it to Han, doesn't he? To Lando, sorry, he is Han. He loses it to Lando, so he's definitely lost it before.
No, he got it from Lando. Lando bet it in a poker game. And Han won that poker
game. He's let Lando fly it.
Sure, well, that's different from having it stolen. Don't scratch it.
He didn't get it scratched.
It's different. He technically did. He lost the radar dish. He did technically. Like, he's never gotten it stolen before until he mentioned it. Like, Duraka or whatever his name is.
Duquesne,
whatever. I was like, oh, you know, really? Like, the Millennium Falcon is way too important. Way too important.
Han's kind of given up at that point, hasn't he? He's lost his son. He's...
Yeah, but then why would he be looking for it?
He didn't. He just detected it and then hyperdrived over there and picked it up.
Just detected it?
Yeah, they say they picked it up on the scanners when it started flying again. And they have been looking for it because he tells Chewie, he says, we should have looked better or longer in the Western wastes.
Yeah, so if he was looking for it, why didn't he find it sooner? Like, that's just another
because
hole.
It wasn't flying.
But it was flying when it was first stolen.
I suppose. Anyway. Right, so yours is no. You wouldn't take someone that is unfamiliar with Star Wars.
I would be hesitant about it. I mean, I have friends who are going to see it, and I haven't tried to talk them out of it, but I did say when people were like, oh, I'm going to go see it, I'm like, you should see the first three.
Yeah, you shouldn't watch the prequels. You don't
need
them.
No, never watch the prequels.
And listeners,
if you are showing your children episode one, you are doing them a terrible disservice.
Yeah, wait till they're old enough to understand. You can say, this is a curio.
No. Even then, don't show them. Just pretend it doesn't exist. And warn them that it's actually a fan-made film that ruins the story. Because it is.
So I would take someone that hasn't seen Star Wars to see it. Mm. And the reason is why. I think that old veterans like you and me watch the film through the lens of Han's character. Whereas I think as someone that's new to it entirely sees the universe through the eyes of Rey and Finn, who are both have something in common, which is they've had no life. They don't know what it is to be a person. That's why she's slightly awkward, because she's not, other than living with some aliens that have treated her like scum, she's had no family, no real upbringing.
No, It's not that.
And if you see the universe through her eyes, like the moments of wonder where she says, hang on, you're Han Solo, so this is real, this stuff happened. Now, I know they don't explain it a lot, but do you need to explain it a lot?
I think you need to introduce the main characters of the film, right? And I think Han Solo and Chewie are far too important to the film, and we just move along once they show up. And she says, you're Han Solo, again, pointing to that knowledge that we're supposed to have about the character. The same is true. The same is true of Princess Leia, or Leia, or General Organa Solo, or whatever her name is. Right, the general
Organa.
When she shows
up, they never got married. She stays as Organa, although technically she could be Skywalker.
The general, when she shows up, she doesn't. They don't introduce who she is and why she's important to Han. I mean, the most we get out of that is like save our son, and so we're supposed to know already who Leia is, and Luke Skywalker. Luke Skywalker's gone missing. Who is Luke Skywalker? We never get told.
It says that it's her brother.
Yeah.
And you understand that he was the last of the Jedi. That's mentioned more than once.
Yeah, and it's explicitly stated that he's important, but no one knows why, right? And if you walk
into
this
movie, and then the next question is, if you say, well, he's important because you've been told he's the last of the Jedi, the next question is, well, what's a Jedi?
Right.
If you've never seen Star Wars.
And they don't explain any of that. And so that's like when Han turns to her and says, it's all true. A new person who's never seen Star Wars before is going to go, what's all true? Right. Because they don't explain it. And that's the big problem. Like, so that's why I would never recommend a person who has never seen Star Wars go see this first, because they're relying on your knowing all about episodes 4, 5, and 6 to see this movie.
Okay, you've convinced me. I stand convinced.
Yeah, sorry, actually. I didn't mean to, but yeah.
No, that's why we have these conversations, isn't it?
Yeah. Okay, so we're going to go see it. You want to mention the School of Movies, right?
So, we've spoken about them before, but everyone should check out the School of Movies podcast. It's fantastic stuff. They've done deep podcasts on all of the Star Wars movies, including the prequels, which we won't talk about. And they are releasing their review of Force Awakened next week or the week of New Year. So just Google School of Movies and they should be the first thing that comes up. And it's on iTunes as well. But it's fantastic. And they partly inspired me to do this.
Excellent. So, and I've seen that you've included the link to their show in the show notes, so I'll just copy that and put it into what we publish.
Listeners, until the next time, that is our show.